BBC Radio 3, the National Theatre's director Sir Nicholas Heitner explores a tantalisingly brief but golden period in America during the Great Depression, a moment when Franklin Roosevelt's government generously funded the arts and especially cultivated music.
At its peak, the Federal Music Project supported 16,000 musicians and operated 125 orchestras, 135 bands, and 32 choral and opera units. In this programme, we'll look at how it stimulated audiences, boosted music education, and gave a platform to American composers like Roy Harris.
A public right and obligation, the music of the New Deal. Saturday lunchtime at 12:15 on BBC Radio 3.
And now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
It's a beautiful winter's day, bright sun, low in the sky, and we're in Herefordshire, and I'm in a wonderful garden. It belongs to the horticulturist Monty Don. You will know him, doubtless, from programmes like Gardener's World. He is essentially, though, a writer. I always enjoyed in particular his column in The Observer, and he's also written books with his wife Sarah on cooking, a wonderful new book called Home Cooking, all about using local and home produce. And there's a new series of Gardener's World coming up, and I think a book and a series on Italian gardens, Monty.
All coming at once, yes, they are, yeah. I spent most of last year visiting Italy, filming a series for BBC Two and writing a book with the photographer Derry Moore.
It must be quite a change from gardening here, and you must worry what's happening here too while you're away.
Certainly I worry, because while I'm away, what gets done is limited, and any keen gardener must admit to a degree of control freakery. You know, we like to keep our fingers pretty tightly on the tiller. But, you know, you learn so much from seeing gardens, and just when you think you've got nothing left to learn, you're shocked out of your complacency and see all sorts of things. So to spend the best part of 6 months visiting scores of gardens in Italy was a wonderful, wonderful experience and a real education. I mean, I learned a lot. And what I find when you visit gardens, it takes me a long time to digest. I take notes, you write books, you make films, but actually maybe 3 years later, something filters through and usually pops up here, actually.
Let's just describe here a little bit, because we've got quite a carefully laid out garden, which I think a lot of work's gone into getting it like this, because it was mostly a field, wasn't it?
It wasn't mostly a field, it was all a field. I mean, it was literally a meadow that hadn't been grazed for about 4 years. So, you know, brambles, nettles, and very rough grass. And we came here in 91, and I started clearing in 92 and planting in 93, and everything you can see, I've planted. So it's a very deliberate taming of what was a sort of both wild and blank. And the idea here is to have a very sort of rigid structure, partly dictated by the site, because the house is in the corner. So to get to the garden, you have to sort of veer off. But within that, hopefully a kind of joyful anarchy in the planting. And again, we have to balance the seasons, because in summer it's no problem. And you mentioned we're in Herefordshire. The soil here is amazing, incredible soil. Everything grows, and everything grows fast. But in winter, it's cold, and it's wet, and it's bleak. I mean, today is wonderful, beautiful day, but it isn't always like this. So we've increasingly planted green structure, which gives it winter shape. And in summer, you more or less lose it. You can hardly see it. But in winter, it's key.
I was very fascinated that you mentioned about the structure which you have imposed, because in a sense, it is the sense of structure that is important to you in the first music. A huge structure. One even thinks of flying buttresses.
Well, the Matthew Passion in general and the opening chorale in particular, I think, is one of the grandest, not pieces of music, but works of art that mankind has ever produced. And, you know, if it was a building, it would be an enormous cathedral, and there would be buttresses flying off in every direction. And it is that soaring, vaulting ambition of spirit combined with a sort of gentlest, subtlest compassion.
And there is something to do with nature almost, and plants, in the way that it unfolds.
Yeah, and also the layering. The extraordinary layering of the voices, even more so, it's the combination of layers. It's not just another of the same type. You have seemingly extraordinary, powerful, things happening simultaneously with amazingly subtle and, for my mind, sort of heart-rending delicacy. And yet they work together in a way that I don't know any other piece of music that does it to that extent. And I have to say, every time I hear it, I come out sort of emotionally shell-shocked.
Well, let's go in that case, to listen to it into your cathedral, your farmhouse, Monty.
Thank you.
The opening chorus of the Bach's and Matthew Passion. We heard the London Oratory Junior Choir, the Monteverdi Choir, and the English Bach soloists conducted by John Elliott Gardner. And in fact, the flying buttresses here, Monty Don, were these wonderful beams in this farmhouse.
Yeah, I mean, where we're sitting now actually were barns. This is a building put together from lots of other buildings, you know, that I guess have fallen down and been reassembled and what have you. So, but nothing a fraction as magnificent as that music. I was actually thinking, as we were listening to that, the first time I heard it live was in King's College Chapel in Cambridge. And it, you need that sort of environment to get the fullness of it, I think.
There are several pieces that we're going to hear which take emotions to quite an extreme pitch. And without labouring the point, you've had quite a series of sort of triumphs and tragedies in your life. There's a jewellery business that went bust, and then you had a stroke, and you've had depression, which you've written about. And yet, through all of these things, clearly the earth, nature, has been something brought you great succour, if a lot of stress in terms of work. And I wonder whether music does, to a certain extent, do the same thing.
There are two things there. One is music is a balm, and certainly eases and heals, as well as invigorating and inspiring. But there is certainly a tendency when one is depressed, or even actually much more to the point going into a depression, that music takes on an almost unbearably powerful role. I mean, for instance, I wouldn't listen to that piece of music if I was going into a depression. And also, I get stuck on pieces of music. Refrains, I mean, even just two notes that become so big in my mind that I can't go beyond them at all. And they become unmanageable, both emotionally and almost physically. They almost become like great boulders. And occasionally, if I've had pieces of music that at various times are unbearable triggers, I will go back and listen to them when I'm feeling fine, which is most of the time. And I'll almost not be able to recognise what the problem was. I think, was that it? Did that really have that effect on me? I mean, the chemistry of the brain just changes so much. But, yeah, I mean, there are pieces of music that, if you're feeling at all dodgy, are trouble.
Well, this next one is a pretty huge work of art, isn't it? I mean, it's a massive structure. But it also deals with extreme angst.
Yeah, I mean, this next one, it's funny we've got this sequence. This next one I almost didn't include for that reason. This certainly I wouldn't listen to unless I was feeling completely sane and chirpy and fine. I think that the Eroica, Beethoven Symphony No. 3, deals with grief in the most sort of humanist way. It is, Beethoven really knew what he was writing about. And he manages to get the range of emotion, but also the poignancy of it, the triviality of it, the mundaneness of it. And that sense of emptiness, how that anybody who has felt grief, and it doesn't need to be grief at death. I mean, one of the things about depression is that one feels unreasonably bereft, unreasonably distraught at things that, I mean, if things are really bad, it could be, you know, something falling over or even, I mean, I've known it myself, a leaf blowing across in front of you is enough to just wipe out all equilibrium. And what you get from the Eroica is that sense of this emotion growing and building and expressing, and then he also portrays the way it exhausts you. And this is not a piece of music I'd listen to more than once or twice a year, but it's important to me because it shows that art can deal with really big things. It shows that you can actually enlarge emotion and spirit and come out the other side.
Thank you.
I love the way Beethoven, as it were, lashes out at the end of that with that sudden fortissimo.
Yeah, and also not just lashes out, but also that little hook, just as he comes down and plays down, and then he goes down. And as you say, the sudden sort of explosion. It's Beethoven, which I've listened to since I was a child and loved, seems to me to best embody and express with nobility the muddle of emotions, the irrationality, the way that they can be contradictory and destructive and angry and yet pleasurable and loving and almost spiteful all at once.
Well, we heard music from the Funeral March second movement of Beethoven's Symphony No. 3 in E-flat, the Eroica, the Philharmonia Orchestra, conducted by Otto Klemperer. Back to Bach, Monte Don, no apologies needed, because the Brandenburgs, where we've been talking here about the angst and turbulence of life, these pieces seem to rejoice in the joy of it and the dance-like form.
It's the dance-like form, but it's also, I find, incredibly nurturing philosophically. I never tire of Bach. I mean, I could have easily chosen all Bach. And I think it's because he always manages to get at these big questions without any angst or without imposing himself. I mean, Beethoven is all over you. You know, he just sort of covers you. Whereas Bach is there.
He's totally at the service of the Almighty, which in this case is music.
Yeah, absolutely. And it is, you know, like everybody, I'm always amazed at the way this sober Northern European figure managed to reach transcendental state better than any other musician. And I think, for me, also, it's personal because I remember I went at about the age of 18, 19, to France for a year. And I worked in a garden and I learned to speak French. But I was very lonely and I was there on my own. Didn't hardly spoke any French, hardly knew anybody. And I had a little cassette player and I had the Brandenburgs. I listened to them over and over and over again. And I always came out, particularly No. 1, feeling positive and strong and that this great adventure was one that I could enjoy and sail through and be enriched by rather than be daunted by.
Thank you. It's funny because we both smiled at each other where Bach has those horns falling over each other in those suspensions. I'm sure he must have chuckled when he wrote that.
I think so. And also I think, you see, it's the lightness of touch. It's the playfulness that goes with real seriousness. And I think that it's a kind of cosmic gaiety.
That's a very good expression, yeah.
That is really the wisest form of, you know, that's the ultimate state for mankind to try and reach. And he does it. Bah, wonderful.
Trevor Pinnock conducted the English concert in the Brandenburg Concerto No. 1 in FBWV 1046 by Bach, of which that was the first movement. We're going to hear Purcell next, Monty Don, and of course that brings us back to England and things English. One of the things I really loved about your book about food, cooking, home produce, was in a way the simple, no-nonsense side of it, that you actually take these ingredients and do the things that bring the best out of them without being overly ornate and actually savouring the goodness that is there at a very simple level.
Well, that's something that Sarah, my wife, and I, who wrote the book, and I have to say Sarah did 90% of the work of that book and has spent years and decades trying to cook and make things very, very simply. And as you know, doing things simply well is actually a lot more difficult than doing things in a very complicated but not terribly well way. The best ingredients, cooked very simply, cannot be bettered by artifice. And I personally feel very uncomfortable with the sort of current cult of ego in cooking, whereby what you're set to admire is the performance of the cook rather than the food. And to me, food happens long before it reaches the plate. You know, food is what you grow, food is what you rear, food is what you tend, and then you convert that with as minimal effort as possible into what you actually eat. So simplicity is a great, great virtue.
Well, we're going to introduce the main piece, the main plate on the menu, if you like, Monty, by Purcell, a piece which actually has extraordinary simplicity about it. But we're going to a wonderful gesture that Purcell conjured up for a special occasion.
Yeah, it's the drum processional, and of course there was a recessional too, at the state funeral of Queen Mary. And when I first heard this, I was just astonished at the bravura of it. The sort of starkness. Now, actually, in terms of a funeral, it makes sense. I mean, you can see that it fits the occasion. But listening to it now, and sometimes alone in one's room, it strips away everything to not just simplicity, but basics. There really is nothing else. And also the fact that it's a funeral, that there's this swelling, you know, this awful thing. This not awful thing that's going to happen, but this awful thing that is life, that is death. And then with the recessional, that it goes. And what is left is nothing at all. And that is both that incredible sense of loss and grief, but at the same time, it sort of pinpoints the moment that it is here and now and nothing else.
Well, in this case, we will be left with something, because we will be left, all appropriately, with a lament, one of the most beautiful laments that's ever been written. Yeah. And the fascinating thing about that, given what we're talking about, simplicity, is it just uses this walking bass, as they call it in pop music or jazz, a ground bass, in fact. And some people might think, oh, you're limiting yourself just using that. But of course, actually, less is more.
Yes, I mean, I have to say, the lament, which, goodness knows, everybody knows, I lose the awareness of the musical structure in the emotion of the piece. I mean, I just think it is the most hauntingly beautiful lament for what is lost. And just the simplicity, remember me, not my fate. That, as I said earlier, that you have this sense with the drums that there is nothing left. But of course, what is left is in others. And it's the memory and that sense of grief and loss which somehow bolsters the preciousness of life. And it couldn't be done more beautifully. a thread that's running through all these pieces of music, and it's not deliberate, is that they all take you a little bit further. Not necessarily where you want to go, but it's this idea of music taking you to places that either you don't dare go, or you're too lazy to go, or you're too frightened, or you've forgotten about. You've forgotten how important those things are.
We heard Dido's Lament from Dido and Aeneas Act 3 by Purcell and Sophie von Otter singing Dido in the English concert directed by Trevor Pinnock. And before that, we heard the drum processional from the music for the funeral of Queen Mary with the King's Consort directed by Robert King.
I might just say that I do love the way that Anne-Sophie von Otter, her voice on that. I mean, I've heard many different versions, but I particularly love that one and chose that version rather than any other.
Well, you're not letting us off the hook, Monty Don, are you? Because we're now going into one of Beethoven's most profound quartets.
Yeah, I mean, I'm aware that, you know, I can come across as a spectacularly gloomy bugger, and I'm not, as a rule. But, you know, Beethoven's late quartets, I came to, I suppose, in my 20s, when I was spending a lot of energy looking at different religions, looking at different spiritual matters. And in a way, these were a guide. I mean, I didn't articulate it as such, and I certainly didn't know where they were taking me, but there was a profundity to them. And I used to listen to them a lot. I confess, I don't listen to them very often, but they're one of those, all of them, and this in particular, this music, which remains important, and I don't need to remind myself very often why it's important. And in fact, this quartet I first heard with a thunderstorm outside, and I was in a sort of state of mind where I was looking very hard at why I existed and why anything existed and what we were doing and where we were going and what we were about. And it struck me, this idea of thanks to great God, it's sort of the deep, solemn joy that comes out of great seriousness. It goes back to the Bach, this idea that you can rise and through it, through exposing yourself and going further and sometimes being incredibly raw, you can arrive at a spiritual wisdom that is benign and ultimately positive.
Transcending.
Yeah.
The third movement, the Heilige Gedankengesang movement, marked Molto Adagio, from Beethoven's String Quartet in A minor, opus 132, and we heard the Guarneri Quartet playing there. Haydn, Montedoni, is a composer. He's often slightly underrated because, of course, Mozart being such a near neighbour. And yet there is a wonderful quality.
I love Haydn. In fact, I go so far as to say is that in terms of absolute preference, I'd rather listen to Haydn than Mozart, and do. But I like Haydn for no great high reason or great intellectual reason. I just like him. You know, I come out feeling better than I went in.
He's endearing too, isn't he?
He's endearing. You get the feeling that this was an optimistic person. That, you know, and as I say, that if one has propensity to gloom and profundity, it's a good idea to associate yourself with people who are a little bit more jolly than you are. I very rarely work with music because I find it distracting. If it's good, I want to listen to it, and if it's not good, I don't want to hear it. But I can work with this next piece playing because it's one of those triggers. It opens up my mind. I immediately feel positive, I feel alert, and I feel open. I feel like all my senses are letting things come in without imposing. I'm not having heavy emotion imposed upon me. I'm not having great intellectual thoughts. I'm just open to what is there.
Thank you. Adam Fischer conducting the Austro-Hungarian Haydn Orchestra in the first movement, the Adagio of Haydn Symphony No. 22 in E-flat, appropriately The Philosopher. Well, finally, Monty Don, we're going to have a piece which actually has a title that refers to your profession, but it also means complete change of mood.
Yeah, I have a very eclectic taste in music. I mean, the only music I don't listen to is jazz, and that's because I haven't got there yet. I remain open to all possibilities, but I mean, really almost everything else I listen to with great pleasure. It sort of ties in. I think Tom Waits is a towering genius, and I think that one of the things that makes him so extraordinarily good is one of the things you've been talking about, is simplicity, of taking things down to this really a very, very simple level and surprising you at every turn, and of not being frightened musically, rather like the drum processional, of doing things in such a basic way, but that have a rich and a depth to it. And also this particular track, Green Grass, ties in with this idea of returning to earth, becoming a tree, becoming the air. And I think that for me, in every way, that the thought of becoming one with the earth is a sort of the sublimest aspiration that one can have. So it actually ties in with the rest in many ways, more than one might think, although superficially it is very, very different. But I love it. It's very beautiful.
To me, hold the earth above me, lay down on the green grass, remember when you love me, come closer, don't be shy, stand beneath the rainy sky. Thistles and brambles, whistle, didn't he ramble? Now there's a bubble of me, and it's floating in thee. Stand in the shade of me, things are now made of me. Smells like rain today. God took the stars and he tossed them. Can't tell the birds from the blossoms. You'll never be free of me. He'll make a tree from me. Don't say goodbye. The sky to me, and if the sky falls, mark my words, we'll catch mockingbirds.
Get a more earthy voice.
Well, it's an amazing voice. It's an astonishing voice. He has a beautifully poetic, lyrical ability. I mean, that's an incredibly simple song. Green Grass could hardly be simpler musically or in construct, whatever, but it has very, typically with Tom Waits, just the right word here and there. And with his guitar work on that, you know, it is so unlikely. So few people would have done that.
Hardly there at all.
Yeah, yeah. It's just reduced right down.
Well, Monty Don, thank you very much for showing us your garden and your musical passions. We look forward to seeing more of you in Gardener's World and in the Italian Garden. And now from Herefordshire, it's goodbye and thank you, Monty Don.
It was a huge pleasure. Thank you very much.
Monty Don was talking to Michael Barclay. Well, next week on Private Passions, Michael's guest will be the young American novelist and poet Nicole Krauss. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. The producer of today's edition was Chris Marshall. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly, here to guide you through the afternoon here on Radio 3, which continues in just a moment with a profile of a composer who enjoyed one of the most important positions in the whole of Europe as composer to the Habsburgs in Vienna. Bach thought him the finest of his contemporaries, yet today he's completely forgotten. Find out who he is in a couple of minutes in the early music show. And later this evening, we're going to visit a city created by one of the visionaries of the modernist movement.
It was built for a new, independent India, one of the very few totally planned cities in the world. How does Le Corbusier's city, Chandigarh, live today? For Radio 3's Sunday feature, Sukhdev Sandhu returns to the city he visited as a boy to see how this vision of the future has coped 60 years on.
I begin to feel a bit like a rat in a laboratory maze. The grid is an open prison.
Le Corbusier in Chandigarh. Radio 3's Sunday feature, starting at 9:30.
Well, it's now just after 1 o'clock. Time for a summary of the news this lunchtime here on Radio 3. It's read by David Cornett.
Western military officials are assessing the impact of their overnight strikes against Colonel Gaddafi's air defences in Libya. British, French and American forces were involved in the first wave of attacks. The United States' most senior military officer, Admiral Mike Mullen, said the operation had made significant progress and Colonel Gaddafi's advance on the rebel-held city of Benghazi had been halted. Here, a spokesman for the Chief of Defence Staff, Major General John Lorimer, said targets were being selected carefully to avoid civilian casualties. Colonel Gaddafi has denounced the strikes on his air defences as terrorism which would be defeated. There are unconfirmed reports of new attacks by pro-Gaddafi forces on rebels in the western city of Misrata. Witnesses have spoken of heavy gunfire and shelling and that a number of people have been killed. Officials at the Fukushima nuclear power station in Japan say pressure levels are now stabilising inside the reactor, which was worst hit by the earthquake and tsunami 9 days ago. There have been fears that additional releases of radioactive steam would be needed to prevent an explosion at Reactor 3. Efforts are now focused on reconnecting power supplies to the plant so that cooling systems can be restarted. Reports say an 80-year-old woman and her teenage grandson have been rescued from the rubble of their home in northeast Japan. Rescuers said both were conscious but weak and had survived by eating food from their fridge. The Chancellor, George Osborne, has said he won't be announcing any more tax increases in his budget later this week. He again hinted that a planned rise in fuel duty wouldn't go ahead and said his measures would focus on growth. The Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, said the coalition had done precious little so far to promote growth. And the weather, it'll be a mainly dry and cloudy afternoon with some sunny spells and patchy light rain in exposed western areas. During the night, it'll be cloudy in the northwest with further light rain or drizzle. There'll be a few clear spells towards the south and east. BBC News and Weather at 1:03.
David, thank you very much. Well, we explore the musical ideas that form the fabric of arguably the world's first operatic masterpiece, Monteverdi's L'Orfeo, this afternoon. A specially gathered group of musicians helps with the illustrations in discovering music at 5. And we head back in time now for music of a similar vintage. Time for the Early Music Show with Catherine Bott today, and the second of two programmes this weekend that focus on the music from the Austrian Habsburg dynasty.
Thank you. Armonico Tributo Austria, directed by Lawrence Duftschmidt, praising the Lord with a specially celebratory Te Deum, possibly written to commemorate the victory for Austria and her allies at the Battle of Blenheim in 1704. The battle was an episode in the War of the Spanish Succession, which was really about the threat of a coalition between France and Spain, a consummation devoutly not to be wished by England, the Low Countries, Portugal, parts of Spain itself, and above all, by the Holy Roman Empire. The empire was ruled from Austria by the Habsburg dynasty. Holy Roman Emperor, King of Hungary and Bohemia at the time of Blenheim, was Leopold I, succeeded the next year by Joseph I, an enthusiast for all the arts and a keen amateur musician, which made the job of Viennese court composer one of the most sought after in all Europe. Perhaps the most successful man to assume this role is the subject of our early music show today.